torches about the room. The banner was a good omen, in many ways, and it could not have arrived at a more fortuitous time. Upon hearing of Harold's usurpation of the throne, William had called a council, including his brothers, Odo and Robert, and his most loyal knights, Fitzosborne and Montgomery, but also including all the lords and nobles of Normandy, Maine, Brittany, and his other territories as well. There had been support for the invasion of England from many, but there had also been opposition from some. Although William was used to ruling his men with fire and sword, he could not go to war, to such a war, without their support. His lords were bound by him in fealty to serve his wishes in his present lands, but to many that did not include serving beyond those lands. It would take a force of more men than we had ever raised to take England, and to hold it as our own. We needed soldiers, we needed ships, we needed horses, battlements, cavalry, infantry, and archers. We needed resources to feed, clothe, and arm such a force. The amounts estimated were staggering, as were the costs. Many of William's lords felt that the effort needed to take such a vast territory as England would be too great, and that they would fail, either in trying to win it or in trying to hold it afterwards. There were difficulties, too, in crossing the seas with enough men. Time and time again in history, invasion fleets had been scattered to the winds by storms. William's lords feared the sea, and with good reason, many thought, as Norman invasion fleets had failed every time they were raised. There was also the superior navy of the English, numerous ships and skilled sailors, who might stop this invasion ever landing on the shores of England. Yes, the problems were vast, but then, so were the likely rewards. There were those whom William could command to gather men, build ships, and follow him on this quest, and there were others he could not. Some men were bound to him in fealty and loyalty, and others he would need to persuade. But he needed them all. Every man we could gather, every scrap of food, every ship, every sword. And this banner, sent by the Pope in response to my missive to His Holiness, would help to persuade a great many of those who doubted in the success of the invasion. The approval of God's emissary on earth in our warlike venture was most welcome. It meant that God Himself was on our side. What better ally could we have had than God? It seems we have come far from the days when the papacy would not acknowledge our marriage. William shook his head, wonderingly. For now, due not in small part to your constant letter-writing to the Pope, my love, we carry the authority of the Church itself before us as a standard.
The armies of England will see it and piss themselves, Odo chortled from the fire, where Adela was pouring him some wine.
His eyes rested with appreciative lust on the shadow between her young breasts as she leaned forward, knowing, of course, where his eyes were, her pretty cheeks ignited. She poured the wine quickly and retreated from his leering glance to stand behind me.
"Charmingly put, brother," I nodded to my maiden to remove herself from the wandering attentions of my brother-in-law.
Adela flushed again as she fled the chamber, no doubt feeling the hot eyes of my ever-lustful brother the bishop on her softly rounded rear. Odo closed his eyes as she left and put his head back, sighing softly. No doubt the bishop was imagining what delights a man would find rotting in the soft curves of my servant's body. I coughed, pointedly, and Odo opened lazy eyes to stare innocently at me. I shook my head, taking my attention back to the banner. I felt pride in knowing that my almost endless missives to the Pope had at last borne fruit. I had been writing to him a great deal, telling him of all the wealth William and I were pouring into his churches, cathedrals, and abbeys. I had sent many gifts to the Holy Father over the years, and, in my latest dispatch, I had also promised him our daughter as an offering to the Holy Church. Now, when we had need of his support, he had returned the favour by sending us the banner. It was good to see that the Pope understood the need to keep good friends close. I doubted whether the usurper Harold would have even thought to try and get His Holiness on his side. Fool that Saxon was! The armies of Harold will see this pennant, and know that we have the support of the Pope, noted William, adjusting his cloak of blue wool upon his shoulder. And they will know, too, that Harold broke his oath made on the bones of the saints. He looked up at Odo and me and grinned. They will know they are doomed.
If they do not realize that already, I sniffed. After all, they are facing you, my lord.
The most unholy of horrors, praised Odo, lifting his leather goblet to his brother.
I think this, William touched the banner of the Pope, gives lie to your words, brother.
The most holy of horrors, then.
Odo chuckled merrily, clearly already rather drunk.
Even more terrifying. The Lord's guard marches at your side, brother. What man will not shit himself and flee for the forest's darkness when he sees us coming?
How go the preparations in the country? I asked before William and Odo descended into brotherly banter. Odo was drinking heavily, and William did not approve of such normally. He seemed distracted, however, by the banner, and had not commented on his brother's inebriation.
Many thousands of our men have been called from their homes and fields, and are but waiting for the final command to march to us, said William. Many thousands more I wait to hear on. The building of our ships has roared into life in earnest. Soon enough, I will take Robert and Richard, and we will ride out to gather more support through Normandy.
Why both our elder sons? I asked. Would not you and the heir to Normandy be sufficient?
Perhaps, shrugged William. But in granting me such a large family, my lady, you have given me much to show in the country. I wish Richard to start learning more in the art of statecraft, for one day soon it may be that I must send my sons to govern parts of my territory, with learned men to advise them. If we win England, then I cannot govern such a vast empire alone. Besides, we should display our sons to the nobles and the common people. We are showing the great longevity of our house by parading our many heirs before them. None can doubt that from our line there springs a wealth of lords who will come to rule every part of the world some day.
I am pleased that you see so much promise in all your children, I nodded. But do not forget that Robert is the heir on this journey. You give so much time to Richard, my love. I would not wish to see a rift form between my two eldest sons for jealousy.
Ever the peacemaker, my lady, observed Odo,
swigging from his goblet.
Someone in this family of warlords must be, I grimaced, listening to the wind keen about the walls of the castle.
For it will not be my husband or my sons.
Peace is a good virtue in a woman, said Odo. But strange in a man.
Even in the church, my lord bishop. Odo grinned idly, the glowing light of the fire bright against his brown eyes.
The church teaches peace in its writings, and yet sanctions war when needs be, he said,
his cup close to his lips once more.
As a bishop, and as a lord, I understand the value of each.
As a mere man, then, I must be left with the war alone, jested William in a dry tone. His hand reached out again and stroked the golden cross on the banner with reverence. I find that too much peace leaves the mind and the behind flabby from lack of use. I would hope that you are speaking of this trait in men alone, husband, I warned, and not in women. I would not like to think that you considered any part of my mind or body wanting. William chuckled.
If there was ever a being who defined perfection, my lady, then it would be you. Men are made for war. Therefore, when they turn to peace, they become slack. Women are honed to excellence by the peace they so desire. One day, when I am done with war, I will let you shone in the beauty of your peace as I sit back and go to seed.
A captivating image, I noted dryly. But I fear little. I do not think you will ever be done with war, nor it with you. Just try not to nurture it within your own sons, my lord. Outside, the wind shrieked as it came about a corner of the castle, as though it, too, wished to emphasize my point.
I will keep your peace for your sake, wife. But the sons of Normandy will have vast lands to rule when I am gone. It will be good for each of them to understand how to maintain their power.
I agree on that point, my lord. I looked over at William. The time has also come for our daughter to step towards her path, I told him. When I petitioned the Pope for his support, I promised Cecilia to the church. It is time to keep our vow. God checks the debts owed to him as carefully as any merchant. William nodded. A little sadly, I thought.
It will be done, he agreed.
I wish to dedicate Trinité at the same time, I went on. We will ensure that all the world knows of our strong allegiance to the Church and to God before you sail for England. William nodded, still looking at the golden cross. His eyes were steady in the light of the torches. The arrival of the banner seemed to have fired something within him, some deeper ambition than he had held even before now. I knew he was thinking of the day when he would ride into battle with it billowing at his side. A warrior of God, indeed, I thought. My husband was now 38 years old, and never had he been in finer shape or with as much experience in war as he had now. If there was any man who could do this, then it was he. No man in England or any other country will be ignorant that we are chosen by God, I said, watching his face, and that you are the Lord chosen by God to rule England. William's fingers brushed over the cross once more.
Strange, is it not?
His figure was bowed over as he contemplated the banner.
That but one piece of fabric may change the hearts of men, and, perhaps, alter the course of fate and fortune.
It is not a mere piece of cloth, when it is blessed by God. I walked to him and touched the arm that he held over the banner. It is a message of right and truth. It is a symbol of victory. A smile twitched at his lips, and he looked up at me.
If all I had was you, my lady, he said, I would still know we would succeed.
Careful, brother,
Odo admonished from the fireplace, his words slurred as they tumbled from his lips.
God is often a jealous master.
He picked at a platter of nettle bread, fried wild mushrooms in butter, and pork meatballs with currants, dismissing them all in favor of more wine.
Then I will not fail to let him understand how I value all he has given to me, William promised, taking his eyes from mine and looking at his brother. Arrange the dedication of Trinité
and the passage of our daughter into the church, and all will know that the armies of Normandy march on England with the might of God behind them."
"It will be done, brother,"
Odo announced, lifting his leather goblet to William, and then putting it to his lips and draining it with one enormous gulp. Chapter 45. Caen, Normandy, April 1066. As we planned out the elaborate ceremony for Cecilia's entry to the church, as, on his lord's behalf, William Fitzosborne wrangled with the lord still quivering with indecision on our invasion, there came a portentous omen, written in the very stars of heaven. Some called the star which blazed across the skies a comet, some named it the Haired Star, searing through the blue heavens of the day and bright against the darkness of the night. It was a great streak of golden red light, with a three-pronged tail that stretched from the southern skies like the tail of a dragon. For 15 days in Normandy, we watched it light the darkness with its magnificence, and for 15 days, men wondered at the significance of such a sign from God. Change was coming. It was whispered through the lands. This light, this burning emblem in the skies, was a portent of something. But for good or for evil, none could agree. Every night, where normally there would have been feasting and dancing in our castle, there were but crowds of people who surged forth from both the castle and townhouse, from mud shack and great hall, to cast their eyes upwards and watch the path of the dragon's tail as it streaked across the skies. "It is a sign from God to you," I said to William, as I gazed from our chamber window at the fire star above. "God shows you the path to victory, and the fire it will take to achieve our aims, my love. His message is as clear as day to me. Do you think Harold and his toad-faced wife will also look into the skies and see the same light as a portent of hope for them?" William asked dryly, joining me at the window. "If they do, then they are wrong." My eyes did not leave the glittering light in the night skies. "For this is a sign for the righteous alone." "What man does not believe he is right?" William asked. His mood was pensive this evening. He seemed thoughtful. "What man does not believe he is the hero of his own tale? What man does not believe that God is on his side?" "Other men may believe or wish whatever they want, my lord," I spoke with calm conviction, "but it does not hold that they are right. You have the promise of King Edward and the oath of Harold sworn on the bones and blood of saints. You have the banner of Christ to take before you into battle, and the blessing of the Pope, God's own ambassador on earth. You are the Lord who gives his daughter as a bride to the Lord Jesus. Men are flocking to you, William. More and more lords promise men and ships to us each day. They know that you are going to win, as do I, as does God." I turned to him, regarding him steadily, and watching the reflection of the dragon tail star in his eyes. "You are the true knight of God, William," I said solemnly. "And God honors those who honor him." William looked out at the star glowing fierce in the dark sky. Brighter than any of the pale stars that surrounded it, its tail streaked across the skies in shades of flame and fire. The pale, white light of the other stars could hold nothing to the glory of its red-hot brilliance. It was captivating. Even though we had observed it for almost 2 weeks, we did not grow tired of watching its path through the heavens.
For much of my life, William mused, I had but the sword to believe in. I am not even sure that I thought much on God, and certainly thought little on what he thought of me. But it would seem, now, you have taken on the care of my soul, Matilda. You speak with such confidence that I might well believe God himself has joined your many admirers. Perhaps when you are near me, I can understand the ways of God better than when I am alone. Before, when I was young, I was so busy fighting that I had little time to talk to the Creator. Let me talk to him for you, then, my love, for I feel that he and I have an understanding. You ever were my ambassador. William kissed me. I have word from my father. I frowned. He worries that if he sends support to you, then it will betray the loyalties he has to Tostig and my half-aunt Judith. Did you remind him of his loyalties to his daughter and son-in-law? William asked, running a hand around my waist and stepping closer. Of course, I snorted. Do not think me remiss in that. I forwarded a message in your name to my father, my lord, to make it clear that if we do not receive support from him now, then he would receive nothing of us when we take England. It was a blank piece of parchment I sent. I instructed Hassan to allow my father to open it, and then to say that inside was all my father would receive of us in the future, should he fail to offer his support and soldiers to us now. William chuckled softly and pulled me close. No man should ever try to outwit you, my love. His tone was rich with admiration. You are too shrewd and clever for all of us. My father will offer support to you, I said. If he does not, then perhaps after England is won, we shall turn our attentions on both Flanders and the lands of the Franks, where he is regent. He knows well enough the power and the reach of your arm. You would ask me to invade the countries of my father-in-law? William asked. I stole my eyes from the comet and turned them on him. Alliances are all very well, but only if those within them remember that the offers of help and of war go both ways. If my father will not support us, then he is not an ally, but an enemy. I will not have such close to the borders of our lands. I paused and stroked his face. You are the greatest warrior I have ever known, and this world, all of this world, is yours, William, for you alone have the strength to hold it. Not even the ties of blood will stand in our way. You are the strength that moves my own, William murmured. You are the heart of all that I am. It is you who gives me power. It is as I said when we first met, my lord. I kissed his cheek. We are well matched, and together we are invincible. They will love us. They will fear us, but all will fall to us, and together we can become the rulers of all we desire. William bent his head and kissed me softly, and then he turned me in his arms so that my back was against his chest as once more we looked into the night skies and at the fire omen that raged above us. I leaned back on the hard muscles of his chest, the supple flesh of my husband warming my body as we looked onto the comet. It is a sign from God for you, William, I whispered to him again, my eyes glittering with the blaze of the three-tailed star. It is a sign not only of victory in this life, but of how your reign will be remembered throughout time. No more will people sing of Vikings, Danes, or Saxons. For in all times after this, it will be your name
that light the fire of men's imaginations, your rule that will be written of in pages of history and legend. It will be your victory and your reign that is remembered. You are the flame in the darkness, the light in the night skies, and behind you, following your path, comes the light of your three sons. You are the chosen of God, William. You are the comet itself, a sign of change and of power. You are the instrument of the hand of God. I leaned back against him, thinking on my own words. In the morning, I would have scribes write up my ideas on the star and spread them throughout Normandy. Another way to persuade still wavering supporters to follow our path. What is true is true. We stared out at the star. William did not say anything, but his arms held me strong and close as our eyes kept on the path of the star. The fire of God lit the darkness that ever surrounded us, if only for a brief moment in the annals of time. Chapter 46. La Trinité, Abbey. Caen, Normandy. June, 1066. The Abbey of La Trinité was stifling hot, not only from the hot sun outside, but also from the mass of packed bodies of men and women, of nobles and lords that were squashed inside its generous walls. Above my head, above the altar, the pennant of the Pope billowed in the light breeze, a sign to all that William of Normandy was the chosen of God. Every noble in Normandy and all our territories were in attendance on that day, to watch as our daughter, the tiny girl who stood at my side with her chin raised and her eyes solemn, entered the church as a bride of Christ. Cecilia was but 8 years old, the youngest noble child I had ever heard of to enter a life of service to the church, and a great prize offered from the House of Normandy to the Almighty in heaven. It was an offering to God, and a signal to all those who still doubted in my husband's right to claim the throne of England. Today, we gave our child to God, and today, God would look down on us and smile. On this day, we made another pact with God. For as he was granted our daughter, we asked for victory in England in return. So our alliances bought, and daughters sold, from one house to another in marriage. All women of this world are passed from house to house, with promises of allegiance and wealth. But for my daughter, the price of her marriage would mean the coming of a kingdom and a crown to her father, the greatest glory a woman could bring to her family. "You are prepared, daughter?" I asked her, in a low voice, as we stood at the front of the abbey, watching the nobles of the lands file in for what seemed like hours. Cecilia nodded to me. "I believe this is the path I was meant to tread, mother. Since you asked me to think on this, I have had such dreams that I know I am being called by God." "What have you seen?" I looked at her serious face and thought that I could see something there beyond the visage of a small child. The nuns of the abbey had visions, it was said. Were such graces already being granted to my daughter? She shook her head. "I cannot tell you of things I have seen, my lady mother, for there are none. But when I dream, I hear a voice calling to me, and I ache to go to it. I feel an arm about me, as though I am held in an embrace of purest love." She looked up at me, her blue eyes sparkling slightly with a memory of her dreams. "I feel God talking to me," she said earnestly, "although I do not understand all that he says."
"From the time I carried you under my heart," I nodded, "I felt as though there was something in you that was different to my other children. The dreams you have are but whispers of great truths that will come to you, my child. When God decides you are ready, you will hear all that he has to say." Cecilia bowed her head. There was already about her a sense of maturity and wisdom, and it was growing every day.
"Even if I never hear all of the words," she agreed, "they bring me peace and comfort."
"This is the true voice of God." I felt as though my heart might burst with pride in my daughter. For only God can bring such feelings to mortal man or woman. To my side, the Abbess Matilda was watching my daughter, her mud-brown eyes calculating.
"You have a pure heart," she noted to Cecilia.
"So rare in these days of war and strife. I'm sure that with time and learning and dedication to the virtues of humility and self-sacrifice, you will come to know God, perhaps better than any of us here."
"Not better than my holy abbess," Cecilia complimented demurely.
As she cast her eyes downwards, however, I saw that spark of pride in them I had noted before. Inwardly, I was satisfied, for in my young and most sacred daughter there was still the ambition of her family. If she was to succeed where our kinswoman the Abbess Matilda led, then she would need a few worldly wiles, as well as sublime virtues.
"Your daughter will become as my daughter," the abbess continued. "Be assured that I will watch over her always, and tend to both her earthly body and her heavenly soul with diligence."
"Your promise means a great deal to me, holy abbess, for although the sisters of Trinité are to me as sisters in the presence of God, I would own to you that granting my young daughter is a sacrifice I do not take lightly." In truth, my heart was pained to think of separating from Cecilia, but even so, a mother must part from all her children eventually. I knew this was the right path for Cecilia. I must steel my heart.
"Your sacrifice will mean more to God than any other, for that exact reason, my lady," the abbess observed, her face as calm as the waters of a great lake. "Because it is a wrench, because it tests you as a mother, because it is a sacrifice to your noble house. How many other families can say the same? Many of them will give up spare daughters with relief, knowing that they will have one less mouth to feed or dowry to find. But you, my lady, do so out of choice for the glory of God."
"I hope God will take care of my child, as I know that you will."
The abbess reached out and put her cold hand on my arm.
"Do not sorrow for the loss of your child, my lady, but rejoice in the knowledge of what you are giving to her. Within the walls of this abbey, she will grow into a soul rich in spirituality and righteousness. She will come to understand the mysteries that others only dream of, and to understand the soul of God, the Creator. It is a wonder that you offer her here. So many women will pass and fade through life, like leaves fallen from a tree in autumn. But your daughter will never fade. With every year with God, she will blossom like a flower under the warmth of his guiding hand."
"She is so young." I pressed a hand over that of the abbess, and felt the grief of losing my child seep through my heart.
then she has longer than all others to learn to hear the voice and the will of God," replied the abbess with confidence. "Although this day will be hard for you now, when future comes to be present day, my lady, you will see what an honour you have done for your daughter. I take comfort from your words." I tried to hide my emotions from my solemn daughter, who stood so composed regarding the nobles. Bright colours of blues and reds, of gold and silver, fluttered through the abbey doorway, upon the backs of every lord and lady. 1,000 eyes were upon us. I struggled to draw myself back under control. "You are the best of mothers, my lady," the abbess went on, "for you do for your children what is best for them, rather than what you desire for yourself." Was that true? I wondered. I did not feel any guilt for it, but we had much to gain by offering Cecilia to God. But for all the rewards we hoped would come from our child's new husband, I hoped the Lord Almighty would also know that I felt this path was the right one for my child. I hoped that he would watch over her. The chapel came to silence as the first sounds of the service began. Heavenly voices burst forth from the choir, flooding the abbey with the grace of their song. The nobles milling about in the open floor of the abbey ceased moving and gossiping. They turned their faces to us, a sea of people watching our sacrifice to God. Incense rose in grey-blue clouds over our heads, wafting through the air, as though the voices of the choir carried them. From the altar, Odo stepped forwards as the voices of the choir ended. He spoke a prayer from the Bible, in Latin, and then opened his arms for the start of the ceremony.
"Allow the brides of Christ to come forth," sang the voice of Odo from the dais.
And upon these words, by prearrangement, many young girls and grown women, some young and fresh as spring rain, and some old and bent with age, walked from the crowds towards the altar. Cecilia stood at their head, her eyes shining as she took the place that eventually should always be hers, if I had my way. Standing at the head of all women who served God. As we offered our child to the religious house on this day, so the lords and common people of Normandy honoured God, too, by offering their daughters, sisters, and mothers to the abbey. There were too many of them to count, a vast procession of novices who would this day enter the service of God. They gave themselves to God in payment for his allegiance with us, in payment for victory in England. It was a great offering from all of Normandy.
"On this day," Odo intoned,
extending an arm to indicate to William, who stood at his side,
"allow men of all lands to see the piety and dedication of Normandy and her Duke to the Holy Church and to God the Father. For on this day we offer the beloved women of our houses to honour God's house on earth. On this day, too, we offer our lords as God's own soldiers, to fight for the protection of God's will on earth. With these two sides of the soul, the peaceful mind and the warlike hand, we honour thee, our Lord, and ask only that you guide us in the path of righteousness. Allow our bodies to become your instruments upon this earth. In your name, amen," the combined voices of the assembly called in unison. As the service continued, Odo's words became lost to me, as my eyes became fixed on the face of my daughter. So young was she to enter this life, younger still to embark on a marriage. Yet, this was what we were offering her as a bride of Christ, an eternal virgin granted to the service of God. Although sorrow clouded the peace of my heart at the thought of giving up one of my children so soon,
As I looked on to the upturned sweetness of her face, I could see all the marks of the most perfect of angels on her countenance. In her, I could see the shining light of one who has found her true path and is eager to walk it. At the end of the service, I, like so many others in that chapel, watched my daughter walk from the earthly realm of this world into the soft dusk of the inner cloister. Although I would be able to visit her, in truth, she was no longer mine. God had claimed her, and I prayed that he would be kind to her. Take my daughter, and love her, most holy Lord, I whispered as I watched Cecilia. Allow her to be as happy in marriage as you have made me. As the service finished, I felt as though I had both equal measures of joy and sorrow in my heart. For in all the depths that sorrow carved from my heart for the loss of my daughter, joy poured in and filled the torn spaces. Joy in knowing that we had done right for her, and granted her the life of service to God for which she was made. Chapter 47. The River Dive. Pays d'Auge, Normandy, July, 1066. Under the sultry heat of a hot summer sky, I squinted up at the mouth of the River Dive from the back of my sweating horse. Every inch of the fabric of my glorious blue silk dress felt as though it was stuck to my skin. Sweat dripped down my neck and snaked between my breasts. My hood felt as though it were cemented to my head. Under me, my horse nickered softly, telling me he was less than pleased about the heat as well. That July was somehow both hot and wet. The days dazzled, yet the skies rumbled often with the ominous sounds of thunder and lightning approaching. In the nights, wild storms lashed against the walls of our castles, and now they came to threaten the tents where my husband and his army were camping. As the armies and shipbuilders of Normandy assembled under the guiding hand of William and his brothers, I had brought my children to watch the fleet gather at the mouth of the river, and to surprise William with a gift unlike no other. Preparations for invasion were going well. Many lords who had been uncertain had been moved to support us, either through the persuasions of Fitz Osborne, through the arrival of the Pope's banner, through offers of rich rewards from the lands of England, or through the service of dedication at Trinité. Our many efforts had been successful, and the fruits could be seen below. Almost 1,000 ships had been promised by William's lords. Some were ships already in existence, traders' vessels, raiding vessels, and personal fleets. Some were being built below us even now. William's brothers, Odo and Robert, had promised over 100 ships each. Fitz Osborne, Montgomery, and other knights perhaps 60 each. Some were made in the Lord's own lands, and sailed here to join the rest of the navy, each arriving to stupendous cheers and shouts of joy. They would carry 12,000 soldiers, and around 4,000 others brought to help cook, lift, carry, to transport horses, and mobile battlements prepared to construct defensive castles and forts quickly when William reached England. Castles of stone such as graced the lands of Normandy could wait to be erected. In the first flush of invasion, my husband's men would build wooden outposts, castles and forts to wage war from and secure a hold upon England. There were some castles and palaces in England, of course, but Normans were the true masters of the castle. Long had the dukes of Normandy known that a defensive fort, constructed either of stone or on a large mound with wooden battlements, could subdue and control the lands they owned. William had many plans to erect castles throughout England, for the same purpose. I looked out at the river with a hand at my forehead, to shade out the hazy sun. Ships seemed to choke the waterways. The largest would carry between 20 and 50 men each, the smaller only a handful. The ships would also carry horses, weapons, and other sundries required for our war to win England. Below us were trained knights and professional soldiers. There were also farmers, shepherds, cowherds, peasants, tanners, and traders who had been called up to fight. There were contingents marching in from Brittany, from Maine, from Francia, and from Flanders. William was also bolstering his numbers with hired soldiers, mercenaries from Aquitaine, Poitou, Burgundy, and even those who hailed from the lands of the north and from the east. It was the largest army anyone could remember being raised, and it belonged to my husband. It would have been entirely impossible to keep such a force secret. The building of ships and the convergence of so many men was known throughout Normandy, through the lands of the Franks, into Flanders, and even in England herself. Harold knew that we were coming, and had already set his navy into the waters surrounding England, hoping to catch us at sea before we landed. He had called the common men of England to arms, calling farmers from their fields, and summoning all the lords and their men he could gather. Harold would be waiting for us. Yes. But my husband was not a man to fear such a prospect. My eyes travelled down to the army encampment, where the bodies of thousands of men were swarming about below us, like ants over a dead spider. They were making camp, practicing with a sword, training with pikes and bows, cooking over open fires, stirring great cauldrons of broth and pottage, tending to horses and boats. Tents were spread out like a city, covering one side of the valley, many of them housing 100 men upon their hay-covered floors. Stalls for horses spread over huge areas, and arrival stations for produce wagons were kept ever busy. The stench of excrement, piss, and horseshit was pervasive, floating over the camp and mingling with the scents of cooking and the fresh, crisp scent of wood being hewed and sawn for the ships. Cartloads of animal and human waste were taken from the valley each day to be deposited in fields and for use on farms for miles around. To leave so much waste piling up would not only pollute the air around us, but would allow dangerous illnesses to breed amongst the men, something William could not afford. The valley was flooded with our men, and there was a sound on the air born of expectation, like a hum, a waiting noise, a restless noise. For the time when the leader of this army would give the word, and our invasion of England would begin. It was taking vast resources to keep this many men and horses fed, watered, and waiting. Thousands of gallons of water were drawn from the river daily, and shipments of grain and other foods were trundled in by wagon with remarkable regularity. Local towns and villages were afire with brewing ale and baking mountainous piles of bread for our forces. But William had forbidden his soldiers to take or pillage from the nearby fields or people. Under pain of death, his men were ordered to leave the crops of Normandy untrampled and her people unharmed. It was a hard task to keep so many in line with their duke's orders. But with so many men, there needed to be a strict and rigid discipline. Otherwise, anything could happen. "How are we to find father in this?" asked Adelisa, walking her horse to stand beside mine, gasping with amazement at the sprawling masses below us. I smiled and moved the reins in my hands, feeling a trickle of perspiration run down my spine.
"Would you not be able to spot your father amongst all other men?" I asked.
"If the answer is no, child, then for God's own peace, never let him know that."
Adelisa chuckled, her eyes staring with open fascination at the sights below.
Since the disappointment with her Saxon thane, she had been withdrawn and quiet. But it seemed to me that in these past few weeks since her sister had left for the convent of Trinité, Adelisa had turned a corner in her sadness and was becoming once more a part of our world.
"Is that the secret of your marriage, my lady mother?" she asked slyly, her lips quivering with amusement.
"Do you tell only to our father what our father wishes to hear?"
"A dish with too much sauce is most unpleasant to any palate, Adelisa," I warned, "just as a daughter with too much to say is quite unmanageable."
"I would have thought there was nothing you could not manage, mother," she observed smoothly, and then beamed innocently at me.
Adela, who rode at my side, snorted with amusement. As I turned to her, her face broke into a false expression of wide-eyed purity, much like my crafty daughter's.
"Are there any about me who are loyal?" I cried in fake anguish. "My daughter and my ladies turn from me, and I am left alone and defenseless."
"I don't know if there is any person who could ever consider you defenseless, my lady," said Adela lightly.
"Women's weapons are different to those of men," I agreed. "But we must always have them as ready as the sword to our side. Now, cease mocking me, and make ready for our glorious entrance." I looked down on the camp, and turned to the soldier whose horse stood a short distance below mine, on the sloping hill.
"The ship is ready, is it not?" I asked him.
He nodded to me.
"Yes, my lady," he said, a mildly worried tone in his voice. He did not want to disappoint me. "I have had messengers come, only a few moments ago, letting me know it was positioned ready for your arrival. As we ride down the hill to the camp, so the ship shall follow as per your orders. The scouts of the camp are sworn to our secret, so that you may surprise the Duke without a hue and cry being raised."
"Good," I breathed in with contentment, and let it out smoothly. "I want him to marvel at the sight of his new ship."
"It is more than marvel, my lady mother," Adelisa assured me. "It will be a beautiful flagship."
"Only your father can decide its position in his fleet," I told her. "But, I admit, I have high hopes for the Mora." I waved a hand to the soldier.
"Send word that we are to begin our descent, and that the ship is to follow us as we come towards the camp."
He nodded, and turned to ride back to relay my message.
"Come then," I said to my daughter. "Let us go and surprise your father."
We clicked our tongues at the horses, and started carefully down the crabby, stony path to the encampment. A call went up from the soldiers, as the message was passed on that their duchess was arriving, as expected. We had traversed only a small portion of the path, when I heard another shout, at first alarmed and worried, and then with a steadily growing cheer, as the soldiers on the bank saw the colours of Normandy flying above the tall masts and coloured spires of the immense ship that sailed about the crest of the hill, and up the river towards them. High into the skies, the blue and gold, the brown and red and yellow stripes on the mast glimmered and glinted, brilliant in the bright sunshine. Hoisted at the masthead was the banner of the Pope, blue and gold, glittering against the skies. The vast belly of the ship dipped and rode over the ripples of the river, as it gracefully moved through the waters towards the camp. At the prow of the ship was a golden lion's head, a symbol of courage and power. At the front of the ship one finger pointed forth into the future, and the other hand holding an ivory horn of victory to his lips, was the golden figure of a child, blazing under the sunlight, like the infant Christ himself, blinding all those who looked on its coming with its brilliance. As we neared the camp, I saw William riding out to us, Odo and Robert on one side of him, and my sons, Robert and Richard, flanking the other. As they neared us, I saw the look of surprise and wonder on the face of my husband, and I smirked to see it. It was not often that a warrior as great as William could be taken by surprise so well, and it was sweet to my eyes to bring him such pleasure, and to give it so unexpectedly. As William arrived, we dismounted on the steep incline, and I walked to him. "My lord," I dropped to a formal curtsy a short distance from his snorting horse. "I have brought you this small token of my love for you, to aid your effort at reclaiming the lands promised to us, and to keep my husband safe on the journey to his greatest victory. The ship is yours, a gift given with love and humility from me." I rose to my feet and observed him, crossing my hands before me as I waited for his reaction. William stared at me for a moment, then at the ship, and then jumped from his horse. He marched towards me at some speed, and then, to my surprise, fell to one knee before me on the ground and took my hand. "My lady," he exclaimed, looking up at me with the strange, crumpled smile I loved so much. "Never once have I been taken by surprise in battle, and yet, within the bounds of my own marriage, there has barely been a time when I have not been surprised continually by you." "For good, I hope, my lord," I smiled, placing both my hands into his. "Always for good," he agreed. "I thank you for this gift, my lady, and I do honor to you for it, for both the magnificence of the vessel and as tribute to the one who granted it to me. I shall make it the flagship of my army, my own personal ship. It will be the first to make a mark on the sands of our lands in England." "Then that is all I could have wished for, my lord," I said warmly. "And the gift that I have kept so well concealed from you all this time has achieved all that I wanted for it thus far. I know it has yet more to offer to you."
"Not so well concealed, mother," Robert crowing from his horse at us. "Not when we all knew and father was the only one who did not."
I smiled at my son, and then turned to my husband once more. "I am afraid it is true indeed, my lord. You can no longer trust your children, since all of them kept the secret of your present from you, under my command. You must from this day gain a ship, and lose your trust in your offspring and wife." William grinned widely.
"Is it so, indeed?"
he asked, rising and still holding my hands.
"That all my family are traitors to me, even as they are loyal?"
William laughed merrily. He took hold of my waist and pulled me to him.
"Thank you for my new ship."
He kissed me heartily on the lips. When we broke apart, the soldiers behind us and my family before us erupted into cheers. I blushed like an errant maid caught by drunkards at the back of an inn coupling with a gallant, but smiled at them. William beamed at the crowd around us.
"Now, come," he said, as his brilliant eyes gleamed at the magnificent Mora as she sailed towards his encampment. "I want to play with my new toy."
Chapter 48. The River Dive. Pays d'Auge. Normandy. July 1066. That night, as the soldiers patrolled the vast encampment and as thunder rolled over the muggy summer night skies, William and I lay on a bed of furs and wool in our tent. Our covers thrown to the hay-strewn floor, we lay naked in each other's arms. "You liked your present, then, my lord?" I asked, tracing my fingers over the scars on his naked chest in the dim glow of the dying torches that burned within our tent on stakes. After my husband had taken a tour of his new ship, sailed the ship around the mouth of the harbor, and then taken me to bed to express his happiness in other ways, I was sure I knew the answer to my question. But a woman likes to hear men say their thoughts aloud. Men forget that whilst their women often may appear to be mind-readers at times, we are not, and require the confirmation of our suspicions and feelings from time to time. William nodded. He raised a tired head to me and smiled languidly. "It is the best thing that anyone had ever offered me, wife," he said, "apart from you." "I do not remember being offered, exactly." I twirled my nail on his skin. "Bargained for, sold off, thrown around, hardly offered, as you say." William ran a hand up my arm, watching goosebumps rise despite the heat. "If I could do all that over again, my lady, you have no idea how different you would find me. I should have wooed you rather than bargained, and charmed you rather than beaten you." I lifted my eyebrows to him. "Then I should have not married you, my lord, for it was a warlord I wanted, not a prancing, posing poet. And besides," my eyes narrowed as I stared at him, "I think you have an over-embellished idea of your ability to charm, my lord husband." William snorted. "My charm seemed to work with you this evening, my lady wife." "I allowed you to take me here, my lord," I disagreed, "as I was well aware that if I did not, you would have simply thrown me over your shoulders and carried me off to bed in front of your men. Sometimes a woman must capitulate in order to maintain her dignity when she is joined to a barbarian." I sighed dramatically. "Men are so obvious. It is left to us women to maintain the mystery in life." "I am going to make you regent of Normandy when I go to England, Matilda," William said suddenly, lifting his eyes to me. Was that too obvious? Or did my shrewd wife guess as much already? I stared at him, dumbstruck. "What do you mean?" I asked, gaping at him. William beamed, well satisfied that he had, for once, caught me unaware of his plans. "When I go to England," he said, as though explaining himself to a child, "you are to remain here, and you will rule Normandy, and all our territories in my stead. If anything happens to me in this conflict, then you, my lady, will be the ruler of Normandy, until our son reaches an age where you will decide he is fit to rule. The lords and nobles of Normandy will swear fealty to you as their lord and master, with the same vow they made to me. It is already arranged, and they have agreed." I felt as though I had forgotten how to breathe. I gaped at my husband. There were but few women in the world who had ever been offered the kind of power that William was offering to me now. A very few queens here and there who had ruled when their husbands died, acting as regents for their sons. Even rarer still were those women who, in the absence of a male heir to their line, became sole heiresses to vast empires, and ruled until they were married to a king or emperor. But to be offered the regency of the vast lands of the Norman Empire, and to rule those alone with the authority of William behind me during his lifetime, without a man designated to be regent with me, was almost unprecedented. "What about Robert?" I asked, staring at William, who was now regarding me with serious eyes, although still looking rather smug at having taken me aback so well. "Your son is now 13," I reminded him. 7 years older than you when you took control of your own lands. Should it not be his place to rule the country in your stead?" William shook his head. "Robert is not ready. He still needs much guidance, and in my absence, that guidance should come from you. If I leave him here to take the regency whilst I fight in England, it will go to his head. I can see it in him, Matilda, even if the loving mother in you cannot."
William heaved a sigh. "No," he said. "He needs to learn more in the art of ruling, and I cannot think of a better tutor than you."
He smiled at me. I was now sitting up in our bed, my mind whirring at a cracking pace. William was offering me the highest of powers, a chance to rule the country I had lived in and loved for so long. He was offering me power, the position of a king. "What of your other lords?" I asked carefully. "Think you that they are not suited to teach our son how to rule, better than a woman would? Think you that they will accept me as their lord?"
William raised his eyebrows. "My dear wife," he sat up and put his hands over mine, "they will accept you, or they will be put to death. And, I would add, if it were not for the attractions of this body that I love so well..."
He arranged me so that he sat under me, and I sat on top of his lap, my legs stretched around him.
"And were it not for the state of constant excitement you seem to rise in me," he continued, his hands caressing my sides as he pulled me towards him and entered me, his hard shaft passing easily into my source of life in one gentle motion. "Then I would suppose you to be a man, indeed, for you fight like one, and reason like one,"
he whispered to me, as he gently moved my hips backwards and forwards on him. I gasped, as the gentle motion excited parts of me still that had not calmed from our last union. The feel of his hands moving with growing urgency on my buttocks, the invigorating understanding of the power he had just offered to me, the surprise of the honor being done to me as his wife, were all enough to ensure that my pleasures were swift and fast to come to me. Riding the body of my husband like a fine stallion, I found the source of my thrill quickly, but as I continued to move on him, to bring his climax to fruition, I found my pleasure was not done with, not once, nor twice, but three times the waves of my own satisfaction washed over me. I felt William stiffen and peak inside my body, giving his seed to me for the second time that night. I collapsed against him, giggling like a child who has seen a fool for the first time, unable to breathe properly, nor to move until he pushed my hair from my hot face and kissed my neck. "I have made you happy," he murmured. "This pleases me."
"You have honored me more than I ever expected," I whispered. "I never thought to rule a country like a king, although I will not deny I have long desired to." "You should have been a king, Matilda," he whispered, running his tongue down my throat and relishing the taste of my salty skin. "You have the spirit for it. Do you not think ours would have been a strange marriage if I had been a king, my lord?"
I asked, teasingly.
"Perhaps you are right," William agreed. "I do prefer that your spirit is inside the body of a ravishing woman, rather than a great hairy man. There are men, I know well enough, who enjoy the bodies of other men, but I have ever found that this body
The body of the woman I have ever and will ever love is all that can satisfy me. And we would have had to fight each other, had I been a king, I noted, my hands on his shoulders, slippery with sweat, for I would not have allowed you to take my lands, as you have taken so many others in war.
You are right, as always, he nodded. So as my wife, you will take from me my ducal crown whilst I invade England, and teach that Saxon whoreson a lesson. You will rule well for me, I know. When I return, I can enjoy the fruits of your body once more. You are a fortunate man, I whispered, to have so much to conquer and achieve, and yet come home to a soft bed when you wish it. I am the most fortunate of all men, he said, touching my face, his face turning serious once more. But if I do not return, Matilda, you must swear to me that you will not let Robert rule until you are sure he is ready.
I shook my head. Tears sprang easily to them.
Do not speak so, I commanded in a harsh tone. You will return. And when you do, it will be for you and me to teach our son how to rule well. Not for me alone. You could not leave me here alone, William. Do not give me the opportunity to even consider that.
Tears were not a thing that often came to me, but they did now. William pushed me from him and took me in his arms, curling around me in the warm bed.
Hush, wife, he said. How little time ago was I saying you were like a man, and now you are here crying like a child.
I will not lose you, I said through my tears. And I cry like a woman in love, not like a hurt child.
I love you, he said. I will do all that I can to return to you and our children in glory.
I turned my face to his. Then let me offer you one more thing to add to the list of what you must return to.
What?
I am carrying your child, my lord, I said softly. That is why the figurehead of your new flagship is a child. It is our child, our future, which sails with you to war.
William stopped stroking my hair. His hands froze on me. Then I heard him laugh with surprise in the shadow of our bed.
How far gone are you?